The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from National Geographic, as well as the Washington Post. But before we begin our journey, let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in these articles that we're going to be reading. They are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. And today on Armchair Traveler, we're going to begin with two more articles from the July 2024 special issue of National Geographic, titled Indigenous Futures. Now, this series explores how indigenous cultures are leading conservation initiatives around the world. Now, our first article is a commentary by Kiulu Fox, and it is entitled A Future in Indigenous Hands. And the article, Fox is a native of Hawaii and a National Geographic explorer, and will explain that the key to harnessing the technology of tomorrow is centering in the past. So let us begin. Water and wealth are constructed from the same word in Hawaiian. The terms wai and waiwai, respectively, are an indelible part of who I am and who Native Hawaiians are. They're reminders that we've always valued the abundant natural beauty and life-giving resources of our homelands. There is perhaps no better example of this than Ahupua. Land divisions, a socioeconomic and geological system that Hawaiian communities designed more than 1,000 years ago to apportion the islands into seasonally responsive slices that ran from the mountains to the seas. These land divisions fed snowmelt along irrigation routes to terraced taro patches. They provided valuable bacteria and phytonutrients to fish ponds. Those fish then populated the inner reefs and, once mature, the Pacific Ocean. The system itself was highly organized and politically complex. It supported a huge labor force and provided a sustainable supply of food for the entire population. Across the world, indigenous communities have long been incubators of sustainable systems. Pueblo and other native architects developed ingenious multi-story housing uniquely crafted for the deserts of North America. Aboriginal communities in Australia perfected the ecologically enriching land management practice known as cultural burning. These systems, like our land divisions, reflect a union of the local culture and environment, one that keeps the needs of a community and the planet in balance. As we all strive to imagine the future, the inevitability of extractive capitalism should not be assumed. Rather, it's important to think deeply about how to build an alternative reality, one where indigenous perspectives on relationships to land, sea, and sky, and cosmos are the guiding force. We should all ask, what would our planet look like in indigenous hands? Charting an indigenous future will require a shift in our consciousness. We can optimize landscapes for exponential growth, profit, and eventually failure, or we can optimize for harmony and balance. To quote an ancient Hawaiian chief, Haya Akele Kai Inua, the land is a chief, also He Kawa Ki Kanakawa, humans are its servants. Rather than focus on short-term gains, we must prioritize future generations. I once stumbled upon an elder balancing the books of a casino in the Pacific Northwest. I was surprised to find that this gentleman was not using a model based on quarterly or even annual returns. His spreadsheet's financial plan extended 10 generations into the future. Over the past several decades, indigenous communities have seen various economic drivers come and go, from natural resource extraction, oil, gas, and coal, to gaming and casinos. It's clear that data is next. Is there a more valuable resource today on the planet? To be in control of their assets, indigenous people should build their own data centers, but in such a way that they would not only be sovereign, but also sustainable, in harmony and balance with nature. Rather than follow the example of Titan chipmaker TSMC, which chose the sweltering expanses of Phoenix for two planned factories, we could situate these critical infrastructures in cool climates, abundant in natural water resources, and reduce the energy consumption needed to keep them from overheating. Companies and countries, too, should think beyond tax incentives and weak labor markets when deciding where data centers should be built. Indigenous communities might offer their own examples for the design and implementation of these centers, powered by renewable energy sources that respect the Earth's rhythms and acknowledge that resources aren't just resources, they're ancestors. To realize a world that revolves around these shared values, all of us must think further into the future. Imagine indigenous scientists using the tools of synthetic biology to heal the earth by genome-editing bacteria to metabolize plastic in the ocean into biofuel. Gaping holes left festering from the violent pursuit of critical minerals such as lithium, cobalt, and tantalum are remediated and transformed into pristine freshwater aquifers, poison sucked out like a snake bite. Imagine storing data in the genomes of indigenous photosynthesizing plants, an idea that already is more science than fiction. In 2017, researchers announced that they had used the gene editing system CRISPR to encode the digital movie into the DNA of a population of E. coli bacteria. Imagine the roots of these carbon-negative data centers simultaneously encouraging biodiversity, treating soil that has been polluted for centuries, and providing fruits and vegetables for local farmers to sell. Rather than cities all converging on the same look of an IKEA brochure, apartments in placeless copy-and-paste office towers, our built environment might reflect local innovation, heritage, and culture. Imagine that homes are once again living ancestors. Ancient local soil is repurposed into bioconcrete infused with genome-editing bacteria that seal cracks by calcifying into new limestone. Imagine building materials with photosynthetic properties that draw energy from the sun or bioluminescence that might dim our harsh urban glare and restore the view of the night sky our people once knew. Imagine 3D printing urban structures into ancient shapes like the tangled, twisted living bridges that the Kasai and Hainitia people in India wove from the roots of trees. One vision of indigenous futurism is alternative history, a timeline where Captain Cook never makes it to Hawaii, Cortez never arrives in Tenochtitlan in search of gold, and the Nina, Pinta, and Santa Maria are still trees planted in the earth. Where would indigenous peoples be? What would they have become? But there's another timeline we should consider, one that doesn't require us to change the past, just the future. Land and ancestors returned. Cities and rural landscapes where technology and nature coexist. Community networks thriving on decentralized digital platforms that empower local decision-making and facilitate a barter-based economy rooted in shared resources and knowledge. Matriarchy restored. Education systems that immerse students in indigenous histories and cultures, fostering a global citizenship that respects and celebrates both the ancient and the futuristic. Charting this indigenous future, shifting our consciousness, will mean adopting a shared vision where the wisdom of the past guides us for generations to come, one where technology serves humanity's deepest values and aspirations, where the guardianship of the earth and the equitable distribution of its resources define progress. Our next article from the July 2024 special issue of National Geographic is focused on culture found in Ecuador. Titled "This is Cofan Land, Ours, Not Yours," is written by Hugo Lusitante. He reflects on how his fellow Cofan took radical, creative action when they saw threats to their lives and to their land. We didn't carry weapons when we Ecuadorian COFAN began working as state-recognized guardians of our state of our forest. Machetes, yes, but those were for cutting brush. Our guards had GPS trackers and heavy backpacks loaded with food and first aid kits for long stretches of overnighting outdoors. Each team of five COFAN headed out for a month at a time after training in how to handle the presence of illegal intruders, loggers, poachers, gold miners, drug couriers. As a people, we call ourselves I, the speakers of I Engine A. There are about 1,500 of us, Ecuadorian COFAN, with a few hundred more over the border in Colombia. Many of our guards had to learn enough Spanish to deliver their warnings. This is COFAN land, they would say, not ours, not yours. Confrontation was not the point. The guardians were empowered to call in the military as backup when the encounters turned dangerous. But that usually wasn't necessary. Their very presence was enough to persuade most invaders to leave the forest. But the Ecuadorian government, pressed by I leaders of my father's generation, had officially designated COFAN-managed territory. These forests, the homeland that COFAN have occupied since pre-conquest times, cover more than 1 million acres of Ecuador, from lowland Amazonia to the base of the Andes. And when our Guardians program was at full strength from 2003 to 2013, it was demonstrably successful. Satellite imagery during those years showed our forest remained robust and intact, even as the rest of Ecuador was losing forest at one of the continent's highest rates. The teams also brought another COFAN from far-flung places. I now see this as a nation unification, Mountain Eye and Lowland Eye, all trading and expanding their expertise. Given the chance, I would surely have worked my own stint as a forest guardian, but I couldn't because of a radical decision my community made about my upbringing. Our history, like that of many other indigenous nations, includes defiant adaptation for survival purposes. The remote little village where I spent my early years exists only because during the 1980s, about a dozen families, including my parents, began moving away from the oil-contaminated upriver town where they had lived. The new settlement of Holmes was named Zabalo for the smaller and cleaner river nearby. My father and other elders grappled with new strategies to protect our forest, our waters, and our way of life in the decades to come. So when I was 10, a monolingual boy who'd never seen an airplane or a sidewalk, the elders and my parents decided to send me away to the United States. In the care of an American who had been studying in Zabalo, I traveled from our village to Seattle and enrolled in fourth grade. I would receive a full U.S. education. The elders hoped this event that eventually, with summers home, I'd grow into a leader fluent in multiple languages and cultures. Maybe I'd help develop ecotourism or bring new ideas that might allow us a future without violation of our forest and waters. As I completed high school in Seattle and worked my way through Brown University and into a graduate program at the University of Texas at San Antonio, this multiple worlds coming of age was my life, tough and lonely at times, but not quite as jarring as it sounds. I had people who loved and looked after me in the U.S. My family embraced me, and every time I returned to Zabalo. Today, I'm back in COFAN land at 37, constructing a home with my wife, Sadie, and our daughter, and completing an anthropology doctorate. My work is in English, Spanish, and I end in A. I dream in all three. What of our Forest Guardians program? It cost about $400,000 a year to run, with roughly half dedicated to guardians' wages, and around a decade ago, the funding ran out. We'd been supported by foreign donors. In our experience, this is how philanthropy works. Support lasts until the funders decide that they've backed you long enough. Which meant that although we retained legal authority over a portion of our homeland, we had lost the most effective and assertive way to watch for intruders. We began to see the new river pollution from illegal small-scale mining. Commercial hunters and fishermen started showing up in places that were supposed to be protected. We received help here and there, some of us participate in government program that discourages deforestation by paying landholders for not cutting their trees. I'm also a board member of our CoFan Survival Fund, which is an American nonprofit, and has received recent grants from the North Dakota-based Azimuth World Foundation for reassembling a modest version of the Guardians program. The current funding will let us train and mount a few patrols this year, covering a small part of CoFan territory, and provide small stipends. And this is crucial for us. The Guardians will again be paid. If the world wants truly sustainable defense of its endangered forests and waters, not just for our sake, but for the planet's, then the protective work of the tribes like the CoFan needs to be recognized for what it is, the hard, ongoing labor of people who must feed their families and raise their children. I've spent too much of my life resisting the harmonious indigenous people who live and think the same categorization. Our CoFan communities are complicated, probably like yours. My own experience, what I've learned from the elders who took the risk in sending me to the U.S., has taught me that the best way I can help is to encourage greater mutual understanding and respect between outsiders and CoFan. Sadie and I have a plan for that. In fact, we're building a laboratory on an ancestral site we've picked out. We want foreign scholars and CoFan working here side by side, learning from each other to produce research that combines outside scientist scholarship with botanical and cultural knowledge the AI have developed over generations. Ultimately, we hope this will become a place for new groups of wage-earning guardians to board and train, plus a state-recognized hub for a younger CoFan, who often don't make it to graduation in Ecuadorian high schools. The broad focus of study we envision is for everyone, of course, the natural life around us and the CoFan language with the history and story it carries. As the elders have told me all my life, without the focus and the Ayangane, our nation will no longer be CoFan. Safeguarding both is now up to us. We'll have more stories from the July 2024 special issue of National Geographic in future episodes of Armchair Traveler. Now we'll go cruising with travel writer Natalie B. Compton. Now, hers is no ordinary cruise, as the headline says. I took the Margaritaville cruise. It's like basic economy at sea. Ms. Compton adds, we watched our budget waste away as one of the cheapest cruises out there. Now, her story was published in the February 1st, 2024 issue of the Washington Post. The Margaritaville at Sea Paradise shortly arrived after leaving port in Florida, and that's a photo showing Natalie and team as they went on this cruise, and it began in Riviera Beach, Florida. There was panic in the port of Palm Beach. Cruise ship passengers in flip-flops and tank tops scattered from the deck, covered in artificial turf, to rendezvous at their muster stations. It was only a drill, but we did have an emergency. We were out of margarita, and this was a Margaritaville cruise. Yes, that Margaritaville. Beyond the restaurants, residential communities, hotels and resorts, RV, beach and ski, and the late Jimmy Buffett's hospitality empire, there are also two cruise ships, the Margaritaville at Sea Paradise and Islander. I embarked on the former for a two-night sailing from Florida to Grand Bahama. It's one of the cheapest cruises on the market, constantly running sales such as $49 trip for teachers or buy one, bring three friends free. En route to our muster station, an anxious bartender stopped me and my fiancé, Dan, asking if we would like a refill. This was the last opportunity to get a drink for a while, he warned Dan and I as we exchanged worried glances. Our novelty cup, shaped like a blender, rattled with ice. How long? Oh, about 30 minutes, the bartender said. Well, it was warning shot. The website had promised a floating island vacation, but we seemed to have boarded an extended booze cruise run by Spirit Airlines. Next section, fees lurking behind every corner. I tried to book a solo reservation during a season's greeting sale, but a pop-up said I couldn't book a cabin for one on my particular sailing. That meant Dan got to come. For the price of $239.20, we got the cheapest room with a window on the 658-cabin ship, plus five free drinks. A few steps into the reservation process came the add-ons. $57 for Wi-Fi on two devices and $188.80 for other taxes and fees, making it $485 for the two nights. It would have been $50 cheaper if I had foregone a window and significantly more expensive if I had added a shore excursion or upgrades, such as the $749 Ultimate License to Chill package that included express check-in, priority luggage delivery, 10 premium drinks, and a $300 spa credit, among other perks. My rate covered meals at certain restaurants on board, some non-alcoholic drinks such as juice and tap water, but not soda, one of the cheapest beverages on the planet, and access to the ship's live entertainment and supervised kids programs during certain hours. It did not include a fuel supplement of $15 per person per night or a gratuity fee of $18 per person per night. Both charges appeared on my credit card after we boarded. By the end of our trip, adding in specialty coffee, some food, and more cocktails, we totaled $780.36 for the room and other charges. Big comfy rooms meet bare bones amenities is the next section. Without buying an express check-in, it took us 30 minutes to board the ship after our arrival to the port. We went through a metal detector and couldn't bring drinks or food in our luggage, which was scanned by an x-ray, although I did get some plantain chips through. There were signs everywhere warning against bringing marijuana on the ship. The final challenge was getting through an obstacle course of salespeople vying for our attention like auctioneers, pressing us to buy drink packages, shore excursions, and professional photos. On board, it was calm. The casual luxe vessel, formerly known as Grand Classica, was built in 1991. It's considered old for the cruise world, but had a multi-million-dollar renovation to add Margaritaville touches. Buffett references and beachy decorations abound, including a gargantuan teal flip-flop statue, a brand signature we also saw at the Margaritaville Resort in Hollywood, Florida. Also, there's a casino, an arcade, and a spa that charged about $180 for massages. It seemed well-worn, but more dated than run down. Outside, there were deck chairs around two tiny swimming pools, or if you're a glass-half-full kind of person, two huge plunge pools, a pair of four-person hot tubs, a jogging track, some cornhole boards, and a pickleball court with a scraggly net pushed off to the side. Dan and I brought paddles, but with the outdoor court being vulnerable to wind and rain, the game was out. Our room was our silver lining, much bigger, brighter, and cleaner than we had expected. The title of a Buffett classic, Nothing But a Breeze, was painted over the porthole, and in the closet we found robes and slippers. The sheets were white and crisp with a subtle parrot motif etched into the bedspread. The mattress and pillows were comfortable. The shower got hot fast, and had good water pressure. A corner table held a $4.95 bottle of water and a $29.95 bottle of Robert Mondavi Red Blend wine. The confounding process of buying drinks is next. At lunchtime, our options were the Port of Indecision Buffet or the Cheeseburger in Paradise Burger Bar. Two of the three places on the ship that served food included in our rate. There are three other specialty dining options where you do pay extra, as well as an in-room dining and bunch of bars. The buffet had an off-putting aroma reminiscent of another budget cruise I took years ago, our retirement home cafeteria. Maybe it was the cleaning supplies, or maybe the food. We grabbed burgers, nothing to write home about, that we dressed ourselves at an unkempt salad bar station and sat on the open 5 o'clock somewhere bar and grill deck. I can see how disease can spread quickly on a cruise ship, Dan, who's a science teacher, mentioned as we ate. We discovered someone else's hair on his plate. When we flagged down a server to order margaritas, we found out we couldn't cash in our five free drinks until we got a wristband on another floor. We asked about the other drink packages, and the server described them at a rapid-fire clip. For $99, we could get the boat drinks package, a discount of 35% off 10 alcoholic drinks, but only on drinks that cost $12 or less. Now, the $119 No Doubts Premium Drinks package covered 10 top-shelf drinks, or the $119 Blender Cup package, which you got six 22-ounce drinks, more than double the size of a typical cocktail from certain menu selection. Shoved a little blender, sans blades, that looked a lot like an adult sippy cup. Each included an 18% gratuity charge. Did you get all that? Ooh. Well, it felt like a riddle. We went with no package, but panic ordered the sippy cup version of the Who's to Blame Margarita with Margaritaville Gold Tequila, triple sec, and a house margarita blend. It was $29 and just fine. Well, we watched others struggle to order, such as the two ladies who had to go back and forth with their server for a few minutes to figure out how to get a Grey Goose and soda. Price be damned. The complex system, combined with the constant pressure from staff to purchase more drinks, became a shared bond between guests. The price of the cruise is fantastic. I'll give them that, said Peter Austin from the Orlando area. But they've approached us, I think, about 25 times to buy drinks. It's very, very aggressive, he said. Next, complimentary food with a catch. We missed a complimentary dinner at the Finn's dining room the first night because we weren't aware there were only two set seatings per evening until we had missed both. We never got our welcome packet. That left us with Frank and Lola's Pizzeria, a specialty restaurant with red checkered tablecloths, where we got a three-course meal for two for $20. The Caesar salads were serviceable, but the pepperoni pizza was too fatty, like they added extra oil to the cheese or sauce. It left us feeling queasy after, so we took our lovely tiramisu back to our room to eat later. Wine was sold separately and couldn't be ordered at the pizza place. Dan had to walk over to the coffee shop to grab two glasses with our drinks package. There was no messing around on night two. We showed up at Finn's at 5:45 for the 6 p.m. seating. The sprawling dining room was decorated with white tablecloths and gleaming light fixtures. Dinner came with a bread basket and three courses. You could order an extra entree for $7, which some people around us did since the appetizers, three slices of tuna and a couple of arugula leaves for Dan, a slight bowl of gumbo for me, were comically petite. Well, my gumbo and signature pasta with shrimp were all right. Dan's Tuscan mac and cheese with grilled chicken and vegetables, and cheese and pepper on the table, that was queso de pepe sauce, was inedible. It's like watered-down Stouffer's, Dan said. We saw two tables send theirs back. I gave Dan my ice cream course to bulk up his brownie sundae. For breakfast at the buffet, I got by with the fresh fruit and English muffins. Dan went for breakfast sausage and some French toast he liked. The drip coffee was free, but nearly as thin as tea. Another reminder that Margaritaville was cutting cost where it could. I talked to people on the cruise who enjoyed the food, people who hated it, and one group that had a great review of their meals at J.W. Prime and Steak and Seafood. That was a specialty dining option. It's been great, said Mark Seeley, 37, who came with his two friends from New York after seeing an ad on the cruise on Instagram. I thought it was really high quality. And next and finally, Parrot Heads have the best time. Despite the booze cruise reputation, Paradise was pretty tame after dark. After catching a musical performance at the Stars and Water Theater one night and the stand-up comic the other, the party died down fast. We could always find live music, and no, it was not strictly Buffett songs. We skipped shore excursions sold by the cruise in favor of going our own way, saving money in the process. Friends, the Austins, did the same, as did a handful of people we met. And Dan and I rented a scooter in Freeport for $50, spent the day exploring the island, its white sand beaches, and incredible local cuisine. We shared a fat lobster tail on the spot for $25 from a shack on the beach. Her takeaway? Well, unless you're a diehard Buffett fan, I'm not convinced that spending $780 was the price of airfare and transportation to and from the ship gets you the best vacation for the price. It's definitely not the best place to get a margarita either. And there you go, my friends, the end of today's journey, and we hope that you've enjoyed it and that you'll be with us next time. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and remember, reminding you the content of the program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, you may direct them to 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.